Fan Morning Show, Sports Net 590 Fan. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Hope we're able to turn the page on that Blue Jays season quite soon. Find some solace in maybe the fact that this isn't the worst Toronto sports collapse of all time. I'm thinking it is. The text line has possibly worse collapses, which I didn't believe was possible.
I don't know. You think it cleared 2013?
I think it cleared 2013.
Why?
Because it was 8-1, Justin.
Game 7, the first round, versus game 2 of the wild card?
Yeah.
I mean, 8-1's
maybe
more extreme
it's recency
than
bias,
4-1, but...
God, that hurt my gut.
And you were there?
I was...
Well, no, you're sorry, you weren't
in
there.
In and around the area.
You were not in Toronto for...
It's tough, though.
Toronto-Boston, though.
You know where I was?
You were hanging out with... Bostonians.
You know where I was, though, for the Boston collapse? In Boston.
Exactly. So you were like, you couldn't, it wasn't a full atmosphere.
You know what? It's almost equally worse at this point. You're right. I'm trying to evaluate them. I mean, 2013 seems like a long term ago.
But that's all right.
It was 4-1, 10 minutes remaining in the third period, lost in overtime. Yeah, that's pretty bad. Our producer, Danielle, wrote a couple Toronto collapses out. Text in 590-590. Is this the worst, though? Maybe it's recency bias, but it really feels like it.
Single game has to be the context, right?
I don't know. I was like at the top of the show, I tried to put the layers together. It's hard to just in a vacuum losing 8-1.
It's a single game collapse. Like they just lost the series. They were never leading in the series, so they didn't collapse in the series. But in terms of single game collapses, I think...
It's historical. It's the biggest collapse in MLB postseason history.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
Okay, here's a couple more that Daniele put for us. So you obviously know Game 7, 2013. We don't have to go through that. Maple Leafs, Game 6 versus Washington, Round 1, 2017. Failed to hang on to that 1-0 lead. Freddie Anderson allows a soft Evgeny Kuznetsov game goal to tie the game in the third period. Caps win it in OT, go on to Game 7.
It's too early in the Leafs timeline. That was still a positive experience overall.
It's just a mere blip. Maple Leafs Game 7 versus Boston, Round 1 of 2018. Held a 4-3 lead heading into the third period. Boston went on to score 4 unanswered goals and win 7-4.
Really bad. really bad. Like, not, I mean, you can give up a 1-goal lead in a game. No problem. In Boston. But, like, in terms of how that changed the trajectory of a franchise, like, there's so many, that's the thing with the Leafs. There's so many what-ifs. If this game went differently, if this game, there were so many stacked up in a row, all these do or die games that they've lost in a row hurts them so bad. I think Montreal's the worst though.
Okay. That's on here. Maple Leafs play-in series versus Columbus lost 3-0 in game 5. Maple Leafs first Montreal round 1, 2021 blew a 3-1 series lead, lost game 5 and 6 in OT, lost 3-1 in game 7. That one's,
in terms
rough.
Of painful experiences, I cannot imagine the Leafs blowing their opportunity versus Montreal and not being able to have like a path towards the conference final at least. That is like the biggest missed opportunity. And it's the biggest missed opportunity because there was so much potential after the series. That's where I think this one falls short. I didn't know how much potential there was after this. And I think even just watching it happen, it's just like, they were never going to be on the Astros level, were they?
I don't think so. The last one to chew on before we talk to Shy, Mark from Bolton texted in, it's worse because the Leafs are a love-hate relationship. The Jays are the darlings of Toronto. And now I completely agree.
Darlings of Canada.
Cannibal.
Well, universally loved.
It seemed like they were never going to touch the Leafs atmosphere, the stratosphere of now they're in there. They share the pain.
I think he nailed it because there's like people want to see the Leafs lose. Across Canada, it's like everybody is pulling on the same lever. Like everybody's in this together. So when it fell apart the way it did, like it hurts everyone. There's not people celebrating it, right? Other than the 50 people that came with the Mariners.
Let's talk to Shai Davidi, our insider, brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB columnist and insider, and someone that had a very difficult task this weekend. Shai, how are you doing this morning?
I'm all right. How are you guys?
We're good. Happy Thanksgiving. Thanks for joining us on such an early Monday turnaround. What happened?
Everybody's still trying to wrap their heads around that. Right? And sports, baseball, like baseball can be cruel. Baseball can break your heart. And baseball certainly did that to many people on Saturday. And sometimes, you know, I've seen a lot of crazy baseball games, and sometimes you know, the momentum starts going a certain way and there's just no way to stop the boulder from rolling down the hill. And that's sort of what it felt like on Saturday, because the Jays were in complete control, and it's really easy to second guess every decision, and certainly it have been. But, you know, Carlos Santana hits that 3-run homer, and all of a sudden it seems that everybody tightened up a little bit more, and the Mariners got a little bit of life. They kept pushing, they kept the pressure on, and they got some very good BABIP luck and just some balls falling in, and it kept going and going. And, you know, there are a million things that you can second guess with the gift of hindsight. You know, there's only one that I really, really stick to, and that's, you know, George Springer was so badly banged up, and my guess is that John Schneider was waiting to get him one more at bat in the bottom of the eighth, and that's why he didn't lift him for defense with Jackie Bradley Jr. And I actually thought that and said that to somebody before the eighth inning happened, and that's the one that I looked at, and I'm like, why isn't that happening? But I can understand why George Springer was there too. So, you know, sometimes baseball happens, and baseball definitely happened on Saturday.
You mentioned the boulder running down the hill. Did it reach a speed that was impossible to reverse once Bowe and Springer collided? Like, we've been trying to make connections and try to, you know, contextualize this as much as possible. But when the ball falls in and 3 runs score and the game is tied, plus the Springer injury, I mean, it felt like a moment that was too much for not only the team, but the fans, the atmosphere, everything. Like, there was just no way to come back from what seemed like a perfect disaster.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I'd say that. Bottom of the inning, Bo works a walk off, you know, the triple digit throwing mutant Andrés Muñoz, and you know, he ends up getting into scoring position with stolen base, and Jays had a couple of shots at it, but you know, the Mariners had a dude who throws 103 in the bullpen, and that's a pretty good weapon to get you through the toughest part of the Blue Jays lineup. So I don't think that was the case. I don't think you ever saw the Blue Jays wilt. In talking to Ross Stripling after the game, I thought he put it really well. He said, you know, we don't feel like we gave it away as much as they came and took it from us. And to me, it felt more like the Mariners taking it from them as opposed to the Jays collapsing. And ultimately, the Mariners had one or two weapons better in the bullpen, more than anything, than the Jays were. You know, and even at the trade deadline, I thought the Jays still felt like they were one swing and miss arm light. You know, they had tried to push on David Robertson, and that was a last-minute deal that ended up not happening. He ended up going to the Phils, and the Jays had pushed on that, and their offer wasn't accepted. And would having him have made a difference there, being able to, you know, either pitch in the eighth or pitch in the sixth or something along those lines? Yeah, probably, you know. So that to me is a bigger issue. I don't think that the Jays relented. You know, they got a runner on base each of those innings. And, you know, the Mariners, you know, if you have Muñoz in your bullpen, you know, that dude is a difference maker.
Difficult to want to look back at the trade deadline, because we've tried to say let's move forward of that for the last couple months. But you mentioned that the Mariners had just more in their bullpen, and I guess that reflects a lot on what the front office failed to do. How do you view what happens this offseason? Is there even a thought of a major overhaul? Is it still running back? How does this reflect on the people that make these massive decisions and seem to have lacked doing so.
I don't think that's the case. The major overhaul is, I get that there's a lot of frustration. I just think that's absolutely the wrong thought process. Like, this is an immensely talented group that is in need of more talent, not of fundamental change. You can look at the lineup and say, okay, should they, there's definitely an opportunity to tweak a little bit, to get a couple more left-hand hitters in there to help balance things out. That to me is reasonable. And then you can look at the bullpen, and obviously the rotation is going to need some work with Ross Stripling headed into free agency. So there's going to be opportunity there. But, you know, fundamentally changing this group, like, why would you do that? This is just a team that needs more talent. And that's what has to be reinforced. I mean, look at the Astros, you look at the Dodgers, that's the bar. They're not fundamentally changing things. They're just continuing to add. And Blue Jays have been steadily adding talent to their group, and they just need a little bit more.
Would some of that alternating who, if you want more, okay, let's say you want to add more people, how does that play into Bo's future? And I thought about that a lot. I think there's multiple free agent shortstops out there in free agency that could be of his caliber. Is the time now to maybe shift him or to think about moving off of him?
For me, no. But, you know, if you can get Carlos Correa or you can get Trey Turner, you know, that's a different conversation. Sure. I mean, that's going to make you better and you can shift Bo over. But I'm not sure that people here really appreciate what they have in Bo Bichette. Like, he is a 24-year-old shortstop who's led the league in hits for 2 years in a row, who posts every day, and who is improving defensively at a position that chews people up. Mm-hmm. You know, this is, he is such a rare commodity. And I don't know, I saw a lot of criticism of him being in center field and chasing down that ball. And you can have that play happen 1,000 more times and it wouldn't play out like that. You know, that was just two guys all out hustling their way to that ball, trying to make a play to save the game. And I feel like people are just lashing out, and understandably so. It's emotional. You're trying to pick at things. But the Blue Jays don't make it to September, and don't make it to October without Bo Bichette's late August, early September. You know, he carried that team for an extended period of time. He won them dozens of games with the way that he played through that stretch. This is an elite player. This is a top 20 player in the league, if not better than that. And he's still going to get better. So I'm not sure why people love to pick on Bo in that way. But, you know, again, if you can get it, Carlos Correa, obviously that's a conversation you'd have, and who wouldn't want to add Carlos Correa? But my guess is that the Blue Jays' focuses are going to be on other areas and improving areas of obvious need as opposed to creating a redundancy.
Obviously things have to change a little bit because there are some obvious holes with this roster, and it is going to be an immensely important offseason for the Blue Jays. But I wonder where this leaves John Schneider. You know, when you're talking to a manager after a loss, talking to a manager or a coach in such key moments, there is a lot of self-preservation. There is a lot of keeping the cards close to the vest, and you kind of have to glean what you can. And Schneider promising over and over again that this group will be back, it says something about, I think, where what he wants, what he may believe and know is true, but also, you know, what he wants for himself. At least that's sort of what I picked up on, or what I sort of got out of his post-game presser. We talked a lot about his future and where he might where his standing might be. And we thought that the only way he could not be back is if he managed his way out of the job. And I don't know if he did that, but there's a lot of criticism and a lot of people nitpicking what he did in this series. So where does his future stand right now? And do you believe he'll be back with the Blue Jays?
It's an interesting question. And I don't think that you're going to make a decision on him based on that game two. You know, as again, this is like raw and visceral for so many people, and everybody wants someone to blame, and this person did this. John Schneider managed that game the way he managed all the other games that he was in charge of. You know, he stuck to their planning, their data. He stuck to their consistent approaches. He used the guys that he would normally use at specific points. You know, I'll repeat it, but the only decision that I really wonder about was not going to Jackie Bradley Jr. and that eighth defensively. But beyond that, I'm not sure that there's something that you could look at and say that is so completely out of character with what he's done. And when you look at the impact that he had on that group, taking over from Charlie at a midpoint with the team in disarray, they were in a very bad spot, ironically also after a Mariners sweep in Seattle, that you can't just discard what he was able to do in 2.5 months in terms of just starting to get the best out of this team, starting to improve, starting to help players improve in their execution, getting more consistent on defense, getting more consistent in their attention to detail. That was really what was fundamentally flawed for them through the first half of the season. So there certainly is a strong case for him to return. I was thinking about this. Who are you going to find that's going to be better? Who are you going to find that is going to dramatically change things or make things better or improve on what Schneider's already done? And I'm not sure that that's necessarily out there. You know, I'm not sure there's another Bob Melvin out there this offseason right now that will come in and give you everything that you need. So my guess is that Schneider is ultimately back. But if they do find someone else, but the Blue Jays should certainly check around to see what's out there, make sure that there's not a chance to get better, and then move forward.
Yeah, I tend to agree with you, Shai. I don't think, you know, what's the most important thing for a manager nowadays? I think that's kind of up to interpretation, especially when it seems like all these decisions are being made as a group and with the front office, and you're charting out a path forward and he's merely the one executing it. I think his greatest strength is the fact that he seems to have a pretty good hold on this clubhouse. And if the relationship is good, then it should translate to at least a performance that is close to their high end. But where I would push back on what you're saying in terms of at least mistakes made is the decisions with both his starting pitchers, taking Manoah and Gausman out when he did. Why doesn't it bother you with Gausman specifically that they pulled him and went to an unoptimal matchup with Meza turning Carlos Santana around? And of course, we know what happened when he ended up throwing to Santana.
Yeah. So the way that I look at that Gausman call, so Gausman is at 95 pitches at that point. So Santana in the previous at bat had missed a home run by about 3 inches with a ball that he drove off the wall against him. And you're going to a spot where you've got a lefty who is going to, with a power sinker, who's going to be really hard to elevate. And obviously, we know now that it didn't work out, but and it's a tiny sample, but I believe Meza had pretty good success against Santana in previous at-bats. And you also look at the stretch of lineup that they were in. All the Mariners lefties were coming up after Santana, And so if you're going to make a move there, you're not going to make a move for a pitcher other than a lefty in that spot, because it just didn't make a ton of sense to bring in someone else there. So for those reasons, I can understand it. Obviously, it's easy with hindsight to assess things based on results only, and it didn't work out, so it's open to criticism. But I can at least see the thought, because if we're here, if Gausman ends up giving up a home run to Carlos Santana there, we're all here saying, well, thinking Santana tongued him in the last at bat, how can you leave a guy with 95 pitches who's been grinding through all this pressure? You know, I'm not sure that it's as cut and dried as people see it, but that's sort of just my sense. I get it. It obviously didn't work out, so you have to rethink it. But I don't see an egregious decision here, like Grady Little with Pedro Martinez or something like that.
No, and it's fair, because Carlos Santana doesn't give you the chance to, you know, back him in a corner, being a switch hitter and a guy who can do it from both sides. You can't really set up the perfect matchup, but, you know, Tim Meza comes on and maybe it's less than ideal, but the bigger issue there was the fact that he just didn't execute with his pitches and the ball left the yard. When Anthony Bass didn't do his job in game two, did Schneider just basically tell on himself, or more specifically the organization, by making it known that it had to be Romano the rest of the way, that Romano had to get six outs? Did he basically admit that this team wasn't good enough or deep enough in its bullpen to truly contend in the postseason?
I'm not sure that it's an admission. That's the personnel, right? And Anthony, they had to use Jimmy Garcia, or they used Jimmy Garcia earlier in that game. Simber had been used the day before. And yeah, ultimately, they, like I said before, it felt like they were a dude short, at least a dude short in the bullpen. And it turns out they were a dude short in the bullpen. So asking Romano to get six outs, we've seen closers do that. But the way that game played out, had the Blue Jays survived it, I'm not sure what kind of shape they would have been in for a game three anyways, having to have used all of your leverage relievers to get through a game, facing, you know, knowing that Ross Stripling was probably going to be good for six in the best case scenario, and then having to bridge a gap there, facing Logan Gilbert with George Springer further banged up. They were going to be in a tough spot in that game. Obviously, you want to at least give yourself the opportunity to get there, and the Blue Jays didn't even give themselves that. But they would have been in a difficult situation there. And part of that is that the Blue Jays needed a little bit more depth. They had hoped at certain points that they wanted, that Nate Pearson would have emerged, or that Joey Merriweather would have emerged, and that would have helped fortify and deepen that bullpen. That never happened. That could very well happen next year, and all of a sudden we're having a very different conversation about the bullpen. But there's no doubt they're going to need another piece or two there, and they may have to think about trying to get more balance. As right-handed as the lineup was, it was the same in the bullpen. You had one lefty in Tim Meza, and that was what you were working with. So if they can find a way to figure that out, then, you know, life's a lot easier to manage when you have more weapons in your bullpen than John Schneider had.
Looking forward, Shai, does this at all affect how free agents might look at this team? I know there's a disappointing end to a season. Does that affect at all, you know, who might be interested in joining the Blue Jays, or teams just looking for the right fit?
Yeah, I don't think that anyone's going to look at this team and say, no chance. And we have to remember that baseball is going to look a fair bit different next year. Mm-hmm. You're going to have a more balanced schedule, so the American League East meat grinder isn't going to be quite as difficult next year, because there's going to be fewer games against divisional opponents. So that was one thing that had made some pitchers especially a bit reluctant about pitching in the American League East. There aren't going to be shifts or the certainly defensive alignments are going to be different. So some of the deployment is going to change, and you know, players who are maybe thought the Blue Jays shifted too much or anything along those lines, that's going to be off the table. And so I don't think that there is anything fundamental that players are going to look at. It's, you know, do you want to come here? Do you want to move to Toronto? Do you want to play with these guys? And is the money right? Ultimately, if the money's right, everything gets swept aside anyways. So I don't think that would have any impact at all.
Shai, I'm not sure you've done the long view yet, but it's hard to believe there have been three seasons of Blue Jays baseball since, you know, our world changed a little bit. But when you look at it, three seasons on the upswing, four postseason games, all losses, a disastrous miss sandwiched in between two postseason appearances in 2020 and 2022. When you look at these three seasons together, how would you categorize this stretch? Has it been encouraging? Has it been disappointed? Has it been wasted? Like, how would you summarize what we've seen over the last 3 years now that this chapter is closed?
A little bit of all of that. Because I think 2020 was a house money year, right? Like, you weren't sure what they were going to be. They were coming off the 95 loss season. They got Hyunjin Ryu. Some of the young players showed promise. And all things being equal, if they play 162 games that year instead of 60, I feel like they probably would have looked something like this year's Baltimore Orioles, a team that makes some noise but isn't quite ready. So they end up getting that extra postseason for whatever it's worth, and that's great. Then I think you look at 2021, that was a clear missed opportunity because they couldn't address a bullpen that was an obvious deficiency in quick enough time. It was pretty obvious that even before spring training and when spring training ended, they just didn't have enough there to get things done. And it really bit them in the butt in that May and June where there were easily 15 to 20 games you could look at and say, if they had one more decent reliever, they win that game. And then that ended up costing their season. This year, hey, they got there in a tough division. I don't think they lost the American League East as much as the Yankees won it. You know, the Yankees just ran away from the division. And they had a postseason series. They got a tough matchup. And in this, which is subject to playoffs, is subject to small sample size randomness. And Luis Castillo has the outing of his life in one. And they had just an absolute gong show game in the second, which ends up costing them. So is that disappointing? Sure. But at least you gave yourself the chance. And you've got more chances with this core. But at the same time, yeah, the clock is ticking on this group, and every missed opportunity is painful. So I really believe that it's all three, and I get that it's hard to get out of your emotional brain and kind of think about, get to your rational brain in sort of assessing this group because of how visceral and how terrible Saturday was. But there is certainly a little bit of all of those things in the past 3 years for this team.
Shai, I appreciate you helping us break it down on this Monday morning. We'll catch up shortly down the road, I'm sure, when the dust continues to settle and maybe there's some off-season decisions made. Appreciate it very much. Happy Thanksgiving, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, to you guys as well, and to everybody listening. Be well.
That was Shai Davidi, Sportsnet MLB columnist and insider. Our insider brought to you by Don Valley North Lexus, where you can expect excellence online and in the showroom. Visit DonValleyNorthLexus.com. He certainly had a little bit more of a positive / optimistic view at this team and what they've accomplished. And even though they've not accomplished some things, there's still a John Schneider-esque view on this is a journey, this is
I mean, maybe the level-headedness that, you know, fans wouldn't and shouldn't have in this moment. It should be visceral. It should be emotional. But he's been covering the team professionally for a long time and sees ups and downs and potential, maybe more important than anything else. And I still believe this group has potential. I just believe this was a flawed roster and, you know, those cracks showed way before I think many expected.
It's time for something to chew on, brought to you by Great Canadian Meats. While you were watching the Toronto Blue Jays and the entire world was dialed in on the Toronto Blue Jays, legitimately all of Canada, Andrea Skinner from Hockey Canada, the interim chair of their board of directors, decided to announce her resignation during the middle of the Toronto Blue Jays' most important baseball game in recent history.
Mm-hmm.
She decided to put that on the internet, and the word not, that really bothers me, first of all. It's calculated. Okay, you're not deciding to do that on a Saturday at 6 p.m. without reason. Second of all, the wording of this, let me read it to you. Upon reflection, it is clear to me from recent events that it no longer makes sense for me to continue to volunteer my time as interim chair or as director of the organization. Was there no, like, there's no really accountability for the difficulties and the situation that has been worldwide criticized? It's about her wanting to no longer volunteer her time as interim chair of the director of the organization. I thought the wording was a cop-out. I thought that she could have done a lot more with how she decided to do this in many ways. But, all right, so she's now stepped down.
Yeah, I mean, the wording, I think the wording is key because she says volunteer. Well, I would hope you got paid for basically taking bullets for an organization for the past little bit. I understand why she wouldn't want to do it anymore because she's basically having to stand up for people who refuse to cave to public pressure, to governmental pressure. Like, she's just been, like, wearing it and trying to fill out a mandate for Hockey Canada. And this is not the best career move because she looks awful in all of this. And now I don't know what would be next for her. Like, this, if she's not protected by Hockey Canada, why was she trying to protect the brand so staunchly? Like, I don't know. It really doesn't make sense. It made sense when she did it because it was trying to avoid people talking about it. But literally everything that this organization is doing right now stinks. And this is just one of those examples.
Hopefully a positive start towards massive changes with this organization.
Are you hopeful of that? I'm not hopeful. With someone who's just fed up.
Yeah.
Or got enough BS. Mm-hmm. Or taken enough of it, worn the brunt of all this blame for as long as she could before they had to make a move here. And now the criticism is going to shift to someone else, of course, and should. But, like, I just don't understand what she or anyone could have got out of this. Like, this was just a disaster from start to finish. It continues to be.
I will just read one of her quotes from a week ago. Skinner says Hockey Canada has an excellent reputation and that the board does not find it appropriate to replace senior leadership based on what she describes as a substantial misinformation and attacks. Will the lights stay on in the rinks? I don't know. I think the lights are on today. And I'm hopeful that this is a start of the change.
And they're slowly turning off for Hockey Canada. Those lights.
I hope so. Let's take a break, talk to Ross Tucker, our guy. Let's recap Ravens and Bengals that he was on the call for last night. You heard him. Got to hear him in action. What was a week 5 in the NFL before Monday Night Football tonight? That's next on the Fan Morning Show, Justin and Naylor, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Sportsnet 590, The Fan.
Fan Morning Show. We're still digesting the Blue Jays' 2-game wildcard loss to the Seattle Mariners over the weekend. Lots of feelings, emotional and otherwise. But let's take a short detour or break from the Blue Jays talk
We need it.
Get to week five of the NFL with our buddy Ross Tucker. Ross, how are we doing today?
Sounds like I'm doing a lot better than you guys are. Yeah, my Phillies swept the Cardinals, and my alma maters, plus the two teams I grew up a fan of, are all undefeated. So my high school hasn't lost. My college, Princeton, hasn't lost. Like A-licious college, Dartmouth keeps losing. I grew up with season tickets to Penn State. They're 5-0. I grew up a big Eagles fan. They're 5-0. So none of the teams that I grew up a fan of or went to school at have lost yet. So I'm actually doing pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good thing it's Thanksgiving Monday here in Toronto and maybe fewer people are listening because literally no one in the city of Toronto wants to hear about those who are enjoying and reveling in victories because we are in our feelings here on a Monday morning after what happened to the Blue Jays. And we heard you last night on Ravens-Bengals call, so, you know, that was a bit of a reprieve. We at least get to dig into something else. And it was a decent football game. It wasn't overly exciting from a point-scoring standpoint, but Justin Tucker continues to be the kicking god. What was your take on last night with both teams kind of struggling offensively and the best player on the field seeming to be the Baltimore Ravens kicker?
Well, it's just unbelievable, and I think it has a lot to do with his last name. There's just something about people with the last name Tucker.
I knew that was going to come.
Just their ability to perform at a high level, especially in the clutch. No, it's really crazy, right? I mean, he's made 61 consecutive field goals in the fourth quarter or overtime. Every week, if you watch the Red Zone, there's at least four teams that lose because their kicker misses the game-winning kick late. I mean, think about, like, the Browns, Cade York missed the kick, the Arizona Cardinals with the Amendola kid who's kind of their backup kicker. I mean, it's just unbelievable that when Justin Tucker gets out there, I mean, even the Bengals know it's a done deal. Everybody knows that he's going to make it. And earlier in the game, he made a 58-yarder. Which they needed to win. It's, it's a highly, highly valuable position in the NFL if you have a guy like him who's seemingly automatic.
Did the Ravens or Bengals, you know, give you any pause last night? I mean, with Lamar and Joe Burrow, it's two guys maybe fringe, at least with Burrow, MVP discussion. Lamar Jackson fully entrenched in that discussion. But you watched Josh Allen do what he did earlier in the day. And then these two teams struggle offensively. Lamar missing throws. Burrow still, you know, maybe holding onto the ball too long, just not being able to adapt with T. Higgins out. Like, it just feels like both of those guys had a pretty difficult night. And you know, when you contrast that to what the Bills did, I mean, again, you don't want to overreact to what happened in the week, but I don't know if those teams showed that they were on the same level or they just kind of canceled each other out a little bit. So how did you feel about both teams in terms of their long-term competitiveness after watching last night's game up close?
Yeah, you know, I think the Ravens just were up on the Bills 20-3 in the second quarter the week before, right? So
yeah, that's true.
I think the Ravens are right there with the Bills. I think the Steelers stink, and I think the Bills made some unbelievably big plays and they were impressive. But I kind of expected last night's game to be about what it was. Maybe it was a little bit lower scoring than I thought. Took the Bengals a while to figure out how to move the ball against the Ravens' defense. I really thought Lamar Jackson missed a bunch of throws. I thought it was a poor performance. He had a really bad interception, and he missed two wide-open touchdowns. Last night's game is sort of a – if you want to point to – if people are not as high on Lamar Jackson as others, they'll point to last night. And they'll say Mahomes and Josh Allen or Rodgers or Brady or whoever wouldn't miss the throws that Lamar missed last night. I think it might have been back-to-back plays. A deep post to Duvernay and then Wallace down the sideline. That should have been touchdowns.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, Ross, I was muted. a team that has been super impressive is obviously Dallas, you know, 4-1. I don't think many people had predicted that. Got the Eagles next weekend. Is there a chance that this team could actually contend for the Super Bowl? And are you as surprised/impressed as many people are?
Yeah, you know, I think I am. I did not expect them to win 4 straight games with Cooper Rush, because not only is he Cooper Rush and it's not Dak Prescott, their $45 million man, but also they didn't look very good at all in that opener. I mean, they looked rough. They couldn't move the ball at all. Their receivers weren't getting open. The offensive line struggled against the Bucs. So for them to bounce back from that and win 4 straight is super impressive. And I think they figured out a good O-line configuration. They do a nice job getting the ball to Pollard, who they should. Cooper Rush doesn't make critical errors. And their defensive front is really, really impressive. I mean, I think Micah Parsons is the best defensive player in the NFL. But they got other guys, Dorrance Armstrong, DeMarcus Lawrence. I mean, that's going to be best on best next Sunday night when it's Eagles offensive line against the Cowboys D-line. And let the better unit win.
Yeah, you're big Eagles next weekend. Obviously, it's an exciting matchup. Jalen Hurts, like, what are you expecting? I know it's a long ways away, but what can we expect, and who has the upper hand here?
Yeah, I mean, I like the Eagles in the sense that they're playing at home, and that crowd will be going absolutely berserk. And really, they're either going to be going up against Cooper Rush or a Dak Prescott coming off of a pretty long layoff and maybe not 100%. I think those are the factors that lead the Eagles' direction. Plus, as good as the Cowboys' front has been, the Eagles' offensive line's awfully good. And especially if they get Jordan Mailata back at left tackle, you know, teams have not been able to get that much pressure on Jalen Hurts without blitzing. So I think it'll be an awesome game, but I like the Eagles in that one.
Would Odell Beckham Jr. make any sense for the Dallas Cowboys? You know, I am surprised, like both of you, that they're 4-1 now after that game one loss that saw Dak Prescott get hurt, but you know, the offense is still, it looks a little bit one note still, but they're making it work with Cooper Rush and they're winning these games behind their defense. But when Dak comes back, it's still going to be the same situation where it just didn't seem like he had enough weapons. But if they had a receiver, I mean, I do think that the Super Bowl's within grasp, because they're going to have that defense to lean on all year. And if they could get demonstrably better offensively with a receiver that could give him a 1-2 punch with Lamb, I feel like, you know, the sky's the limit. Is there any chance they could, you know, plug that hole? And does Beckham make sense, any sense for them?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably a lot of teams that could benefit from Odell Beckham Jr. if he's healthy later on in the season, just to provide another option. But I think especially with getting Michael Gallup back, I think the Cowboys are okay. I mean, they want to lean on the run game anyway. They got CeeDee Lamb. They've got Michael Gallup. They have a tight end they really like in Dalton Schultz. So, I mean, they could certainly use him, but I think there's probably teams like the Packers or maybe the Rams. I mean, there's teams that could probably use him more.
It's not just a two-horse race in the NFC East, at least right now, with the Giants 4-1 as well after beating the Packers in London. Of course, they haven't passed the same test that Dallas and the Eagles have, but they're showing incredible improvement under Brian Daboll, and that improvement is seen most profoundly in Daniel Jones. Who do you think we should be, like, heaping praise on here? Is it Jones taking a huge step forward? Is it Daboll finding a way to make sure that his strengths are highlighted week after week? Like, what's happening in New York? How have they had such a great start?
Well, you said it. It's coaching. I mean, it is. And I think it's not just Brian Daboll. It's their offensive coordinator, Mike Kafka, who they got from the Chiefs. Because if you watch, not only are the Giants, you know, much better than they were under Joe Judge, but they're just so much more entertaining. I mean, they tried to run like a Philly special down near the goal line. It wasn't open, so the tight end Bellinger took it himself in for a touchdown. They had Saquon out of the Wildcat. He had a big run out of that, and then he also scored a touchdown. They're just a lot more interesting. They're just a lot more fun to watch and entertaining, which is a big part of it, and certainly they deserve a lot of credit to the coaches for using that creativity. I mean, the O-line's beat up. They're down a bunch of receivers. Even Daniel Jones, Saquon got hurt during the game. Daniel Jones has a bad ankle, and they still beat the Packers.
Ross, big game yesterday for those Bills fans. Seeing Josh Allen continue to do what he does, how big of a gap do you think he has in that MVP race now?
That's a good question, Ailish. I don't think it's that big of a gap. I think he's up there, but I think so is Jalen Hurts. So is Lamar Jackson, probably. I mean, Jalen Hurts, Eagles are undefeated, and Hurts is playing very well. I don't know. I'm guessing Josh Allen would probably win it right now. I have to look and see what the odds are. Those throws he made, I don't know how the Steelers let that happen. But the second one where Gabe Davis, like, it hit off his hand, and then Minkah Fitzpatrick had that in his arms. I mean, it should have been an interception. And then Gabe Davis just wanted it more and ripped it out. I got to tell you, I was very surprised. I have a betting podcast, the Even Money betting podcast. I like the Steelers and the points. I thought it was, after back-to-back hard-fought games for the Bills down in Miami and the Heat and then the Ravens comeback, I thought the Bills were kind of primed for a slug it out. I still thought the Bills would win by 10, right? Like 27-17 maybe. But I thought the Steelers would play better with Kenny Pickett, giving them a spark. I mean, that was an absolute master blasting by the Bills that you did not expect of the Steelers. I mean, the Steelers are going to have the first losing season under Mike Tomlin. It's rare times in Pittsburgh right now.
Josh Allen is currently a plus 200 favorite to win the MVP. He might have been a plus 150 by the end of that game if they needed him to continue racking up the stats, but he got to put it in cruise control with that game getting out of hand. Last one for you here, Ross. What do you think the 49ers' ceiling is here? They had a weird start to the year, losing in that monsoon in Chicago, but they now have the second best point differential in the NFL, tied with the Philadelphia Eagles and only behind the Buffalo Bills. Are they sort of a sleeping giant, do you think, in the NFC?
Yeah, I think they have as good a chance to win the NFC as anybody. I really do. I mean, just the way they are, the way their defense is playing, although I'm a little bit curious about the Bosa groin injury. I think Emmanuel Mosley tore his ACL. So those are things to keep an eye on for sure. You look at the complexion of the NFC, I think the Niners, especially the way they ran the ball, Jimmy G probably had his best game. I think they have a chance, as good a chance as anyone, to get to the Super Bowl from the NFC.
Ross, didn't really appreciate the shots off the top, but do appreciate you coming on early for us this morning. Big weekend ahead for Dartmouth. You know, UNH should be an easy one. We got to get back in the win column, right?
Yeah, I don't think it's going to be an easy one, but good luck to you, Ailish.
I wish I bump the guys up, you know?
Yeah, you know, if you're bored, Friday night, the Princeton Tigers will win again on ESPNU if you want to check that out.
Oh, that is a big matchup. We're only 4 weeks away for our matchup, November 5th. Can't wait.
Oh, man, I'm feeling pressure already. We better not blow. Dartmouth always has our number for some unknown reason,
right?
Because their D coordinator was my coach at Princeton. Awesome dude.
All right, we'll have to put something on the line. Ross, appreciate you joining us this morning, and we'll chat with you next week.
See you guys.
Ross Tucker, former NFL offensive lineman, host of the Ross Tucker Football Podcast, Westwood One analyst, Princeton Tiger, November 5th, rapidly approaching the Big Green versus the Tigers. I'm sure we won't have any conversation about that the next morning. We got Arden Zwelling next on the break. We were taking your texts in about just generally, how are you feeling, guys? How's the fan base feeling this morning? You know, we've kind of gone through all of the emotions. I think at the top of the show, I was a little bit frustrated. You know, Shai Davidi gave us a little bit of clarity. Arden's Welling was there in the building at the tough post game hits to do. We'll continue to kind of brush it out here, see how everyone feels. But text in 590-590. Also, you got to text in your Wake and Rake submissions. We're back at it. Monday Night Football tonight. We need you to just text that in 590-590 to be our anchor for our parlay. Let's take a break, and we'll have Arden's Welling after. That's next on the Fan Morning Show with Justin and Ayler, Sportsnet 590, The Fan.